by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab.
Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. This is our second hour, May 17th, 2014. We've got a rebroadcast of Robert Paxton. He wrote a book on fascism, The Anatomy of Fascism. He's fascinating, authoritative history of fascism. And so listen very carefully to what he has to say, because he's really right on top of it. And it's just a fine book. And we thought we'd bring this discussion up going into the Bilderberg meeting at the end of this particular month. We will be in Copenhagen we'll arrive there on the 28th of May. And we'll be departing there, returning to Austin, Texas on June 2nd. We will be broadcasting. We will be producing. Farrell Montgomery and myself will be producing a symposium live from Copenhagen on May 30th and the 31st. Those 2 days. And then also, in addition to that, we're going to be doing some work down in front of the Marriott Hotel there in downtown Copenhagen on the 29th. And we may return and come back and do some more work in front of the hotel with the protesters on it would be June 1st, which would be a Sunday. Our broadcast is planned to be on a Friday and Saturday, and we begin one day after the first day that the Bilderberg group is meeting there in downtown Copenhagen at the Marriott Hotel, Copenhagen. So we're going to have some fine guests. We're going to have Luke Rakowski, hope to have Lord Mockton in there. Tony Gosling cannot make it and be on the ground as our master of ceremonies. So instead, we're going to be taking care of those duties ourselves initially until we find a master of ceremonies. We might find someone else that's suitable between now and then. Tony Gosling was just the ideal person. And what I must say, too, is that we're being rebroadcast these first 2 hours with commentary at the beginning of each hour. But there'll be a third bonus hour. There's up on the website now. You can go to thesecrettruth.com, and there is a bonus hour of an hour, and it's an interview that I pre-recorded with Tony Gosling on Friday, and it will be broadcast live on Saturday tonight. So and we're going to go into a lot of different angles on the Bilderberg. He is considered to be one of the foremost experts on the Bilderberg group in the world, and he broadcasts out of Bristol, England. He's been a broadcaster for a number of years, nearly 2 decades. He's had experience, wide experience with BBC and other public organizations over there. And so we hope to have a live broadcast with him directly. We might be streaming some of our broadcast directly onto his live drive home program. There is 2-hour program in Bristol, England on Friday. And that would be on the 30th of May on Friday. We hope to do that. We'll be discussing 12 of what we consider to be the most dangerous major world problems. And I guess everyone has their own list, and they can tick off 12 things, 15. You could probably go up to 40 or 50 very easily. We seem to want to end the, you know, limit this to about 12 because we had 2 days of broadcast, and so we needed to be sure that we could cover, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, enough speakers and so forth to make it you know, work out for the 2 days. We're in there to broadcast between 9 in the morning to 7 in the evening with about an hour and 15 minutes for lunch. So we're going to have hopefully enough time to carry this off. But you know, you never have much time. We're going to be Skyping in. We've invited John Apfley out of Washington State. He did a fine master of ceremonies along with David Yurth for our Fukushima conference in May, in March of 22nd and 23rd of March here in Austin, Texas. We are inviting him. We don't have confirmation on that. We certainly welcome him to speak. And we're gonna he will be covering the new medical model, so to speak. Anyway, let me start ticking these problems off here and just sort of, you know, create some kind of conversation out there among my listening audience. The number one problem we're listing here is Fukushima Daiichi. It's a continual catastrophe. It's ongoing. We did the Fukushima Solutions World Conference. We did perhaps save one girl's life on a root canal situation. And there's other people that are beginning to think about holding a conference on the West Coast. More the merrier. We might be a catalyst more than anything during that conference. We didn't attain all the goals that we wanted to, but John Apsley and Steve Hines, two fine doctors, they put a lot out there. David Yurth did a lot of fine things also. Hester, well, special thanks for Hester out there. She's been really a supporter of our activities, and she really dug down in her pocket. And Hester, we thank you and love you a bunch. Mary Anderson, thank you. Randall Mock, can't say how much we owe you for thanks and so forth. And those are just a few of the people. Jim Leverett did a lot of tying up a lot of loose ends, and he made a lot of good contributions. And Jan also asked some fine questions at the conference in Austin. So number one, it's an ongoing disaster that's spewing forth. We hope to have Helen Caldicott come in on that first or second day, either to open the conference, a symposium for us, or to close it or whatever. But anyway, we're working with her people now out of New York, Molly Lightfoot up there. So number two, let's go into the 9/11, okay? And we could just do, you know, a symposium just on that subject alone. There's enough there talking about 9/11. What are the implications for the future? Well, it's the most diabolical act ever committed against the United States because it's being used by all of these people. Obama, George W. Bush, all of these people out there, all these big power elitists and the Bilderberg people. There was a recent, you know what I mean, ceremony in New York City that Obama and all these people spoke at. But no one is working on the truth on this, the 9/11 truth. Not any of the government people are striving to attain truth on this. Only people, okay, that have been outside of the mainstream, that are outside of the main press, have stepped out at a great risk. And Alex Jones has been one of the leaders in this. I've done a little bit on my part. I've broadcast three of these international 9/11 truth conferences, along with Charlotte Littlefield. Charlotte Littlefield has stood up on this. And there's just a slew of people. George Riley did a documentary called In Plain Truth, In Plain Sight, P-L-A-N-E, Sight, about there not being any, you know, fuselage parts in front of the Pentagon. But the problem with this right now is that the American public is still believing that the attack on the World Trade Center there and the Pentagon They still, the American public is still mesmerized and propagandized and mind-washed into the idea that it was a legitimate attack by a foreign terrorist. There's a lot of evidence out here that it was more than just these foreign terrorists and Osama bin Laden over there in some kind of a cave in Afghanistan, you know, could launch an attack like this. This was a major attack. We have people out of Copenhagen that have come to these conferences that are world-renowned chemists. One doctor in particular, Niels Harrit out of Copenhagen, and we'll see him when we're over there into this month. He helped do the analysis on some of the dust in three different samples that were given to him, and he found that there was thermite on a nanotechnology basis in that dust. And this was corroborated by other people also. Dr. Jones out of Brigham Young, Stephen Jones, he worked with him on this, on verifying this and so forth. And so, but he came under heavy fire. If you go to our site now, I put the video that the BBC used. There was a 2-hour interview that they did with Niels Harrit. Niels Harrit's a fine person. He believes in truth and stands on truth. He's a heck of a good Dane and a heck of a good citizen for Denmark. And he stood up during this and said things and stood his ground. And his ground is on the truth, grounds of truth. And BBC was trying to go in there and besmirch his opinion and things like this. And so you can look at that and make your own mind up on what BBC. BBC is just another big, media being controlled by the big money. They put themselves out like, oh, they're really for the people and all this stuff. But in the end, who holds sway is the big money. So anyway, we're going to get into 9/11 truth and flesh that out. The money problem. The central banks, most of the central banks in the Western economies are monopolized by a certain number of private owners or corporate owners, and thus the monopoly of money creation is a real problem. That's we're listing that as problem number 3. We're not listing these particularly all the way through in the highest priority or the biggest problems areas that we can. I just put them out there pretty loosely. The order is not exactly from the highest priority of the worst to the least worst. And the Bank of England, it was created in 1694. The Federal Reserve System established 1930. It gave the monopoly of the creation of credit to a few credit. And this credit creation out of thin air is the problem, see. Now they're doing quantitative easing. We have a new Federal Reserve Chairman, Yellen. She's doing nothing but doing the same thing that Bernanke did. And they have to keep the banks afloat. The derivatives market, they have tremendous losses and overhangs of debt and because of derivatives trading and losses. They've never reconciled those yet. And when the day comes that they have to reconcile that, many of these large institutions are going to be gone. Food, it poisons us in today's world, the GMO. The Europeans have escaped out of that and prohibiting the GMO foods over there. They're smart. We have them all over this country. We got to get rid of them and follow the lead of the Europeans. That's number 4, food, and I said it poisons us. Number 5, panopticon. The panopticon came about through it's an idea of creating a prison where you, from one central guard point, you can look at a number of prisoners directly. But there's this surveillance grid, the NSA. Snowden reveals some of that. We're going to talk. I worked for the ASA and ended up my last year on the Teufelsberg in West Berlin. And I've got a few insights there, but we're going to have experts on that speak to that. The delusion, educating into delusion. I'm going to have a few things to say about what I call the new school. And I'm going to set out at this symposium, the new school. Number seven, the environment. It's a manipulation. The environmental issues. There have been some new breaking news now about the Antarctic, and then all of a sudden, it's not what they said it is. It says hundreds of years in the future these things may happen. I mean, they're continually writing articles and hyping up things that when you first read them, oh, gosh, that's terrible. We've got to do something right now. And then you find out these are predictions that might take 100 years to happen soon. We've got to look at this and separate the real facts from this manipulation. It's become a political system, a political tool to manipulate a large number of people who've been heavily indoctrinated through our school system into anything that the environmentalists say they believe. Okay? Well, some of the things they say are not true, and they're not backed up by. I have a friend of mine. He gets into arguments on Facebook. And anyway, David will put forward and he say, okay, tell me the facts and tell me the experiment that can back up your statement. And all these people, when he confronts them, they'll say things about global warming, this and that, and say, tell me an experiment, tell me a set, and have it duplicated and all that. Then they go away. They get mad because there's not proof that they can back up some of these opinions with. They put a lot of that stuff in our heads, see, and we just repeat like a bunch of parrots. The jungle is full of parrots, and all we do is just parrot, you know. And we don't think for ourselves enough. We've got to be self-thinking and evaluate things and start thinking for ourselves and not just repeating all of these parroted type of propaganda, you know, little quips and things like this. We need top secret encryption for individuals. We should take away all encryption for governments. Government should not have any ability to make anything secret, and we should have full transparency as a result of that. This medicine, John Apsley is pioneering in the new medical model. We hope to have him speak with us, and hopefully Steve Hines out of West Texas. The pharmaceuticals, we know what they've been up to. Once they got into our advertising matrix, they've been just hammering away at all of these great new medicines that we just have to have, you know. I mean, without these new medicines, we wouldn't make it. Oh, but what they say at the end of the ad is greater than what the ad was because of the side effects. So there's one that is hilarious. It's probably a 2-minute ad, and it has maybe 35 to 40 seconds of the hype on the drug, you know. Oh, it's this and that, and can take away this, and oh, you'll sleep so content, man, or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden, they go on an explanation of the side effects and so forth that last longer than the ad, you know. I mean, it is just so ridiculous sometimes what's going on out here, and people haven't caught on to it yet. We've been dumbed down. We got the fluoride in us. We got a lot of junk in our heads and so forth, and we need to sort of shake out of that, you know. Number 12, that was number 11, pharmaceuticals. Number 12 is hatred and forgiveness. And forgiving is what I say is a cult breaker and establishes the real objectivity, okay? And so we gotta get down to forgiveness. And on my site, on our site, WeThePeopleBilderberg.com, go to that. And go to program, and you'll see those 12 different problems. Right below that, you'll say the way to win, and it's elimination of evil and the secret of eliminating evil. And I put together a little minute and a half video there that you can look at about one way that we can step up to the plate and make a difference in the world. But it involves personal responsibility, and it also involves in getting out there and doing something, and risking taking a risk. And whether you turn in someone that's been doing something illegally or highly dangerous to our country or detrimental to our country, Or you go out and stand on a protest line and make a sign, or you talk to people and try to expose some of the corruption, or anything. It takes individuals, and you don't have to take credit. And the way that I'm proposing that you do this is not for credit at all. In fact, the proposal I'm making in this little video on there is that it's better to go out and do this, do these things, and what I would say, alone anonymous actions, or actions alone anonymously done. And I think we can have more effect that way. We can not only change the world, but we can work from an area that is very, very hard to stop. It can create a certain mountain of goodness that can sweep over all of this evil bunch that is in there manipulating everybody and just plundering the country. Today, America is being plundered by these pirates, and they used to, take ships down and plunder and throw everyone overboard and take the gold and the ship and rename it and so forth. Today, they're taking whole countries down and plundering them. We've got to get a grip here on this country and this world, and we've got to wake up. Waking up is a very, very difficult thing to do, and it may be near impossible, but I'm going to try to help each and every one of you do that. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this rebroadcast hour. Good night.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler, and Charlotte Littlefield, my co-host, is off tonight.
Surprise, George.
We've got just a really... What's that?
Surprise, George. I'm here.
Oh, okay. Well, she was off. You came back in, huh? Well, welcome, Charlotte, to our program.
Thank you, George. I couldn't miss Robert Paxton. You've booked such an amazing guest tonight.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Paxton. He was born in Lexington, Virginia, educated at Washington and Lee University before earning an MA at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, and he earned his PhD at Harvard University. He also taught at the University of California at Berkeley and the State University of New York at Stony Point before joining the faculty of Columbia University in New York, where he is now Emeritus Professor of History. In April of 2009, the French government bestowed on him and awarded Dr. Paxton the Legion of Honor. Welcome to our program, Dr. Robert Paxton.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, we really appreciate you being able to come on to our program. We're talking tonight about this book about the anatomy of fascism. How long did it take you to put that together, Doctor?
Well, it grows out of a course that I taught for about 20 years, but the writing, I guess, took me 6 or 8, but I was working full-time at other things, but it took me a long time.
You know, you have this definition. Let me read this definition. Some of our listening audience is new to some of these terms, and some are really into it deeply. But let me read you this definition that you came up with, which is really great and very insightful. This is, quote, fascism may be defined as a form of political behavior marked by obsessive preoccupation with community decline, humiliation, or victimhood, and by compensatory cults of unity, energy, and purity, in which a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants, working in uneasy but effective collaboration with traditional elites, abandons democratic liberties and pursues with redemptive violence and without ethical or legal restraints goals of internal cleansing and external expansion. Boy, I tell you, you really put a lot of thought in that, didn't you?
Well, I tried to make it shorter, but I wanted to fit all the parts in, so it had to be kind of long.
And what, sir? Good evening. I'm Charlotte Littlefield. I was wondering what countries were you thinking of? Basic examples that come to your mind about fascism.
Well, the two main examples are Italy and Germany. It was in Italy that Mussolini invented the term, and I think he invented the practice. And then Hitler came along 10 years later and carried it much further. Those are the two countries where fascism came to power and exercised power, and in Hitler's case, took it to its absolute, utter, final conclusion. But there were fascist movements in every European country and in the United States in the 1930s.
You seem to say in your book and your some of the excerpts that I've read that it's hard to define it too strictly, like America's form of fascism might be different than that of Europe. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yeah, I thought that every country, fascism was just a little bit different in every country because fascists are nationalists and they want to put their national identity first. And so the kinds of imagery and the kinds of issues that appealed in one country and could justify a dictatorship in one country wouldn't be exactly the same as the others. And so if you tried, and George Lincoln Rockwell tried in the United States to create a Nazi party with the swastika and all those things, and it was perceived as foreign. But a man named Paley with the silver shirts, he used American symbolism, and then it went down a little bit better. So the symbols and even the issues differ with each nation.
Right.
But the kind of aims you have are always the same. That is to say, you set aside democracy because you think it's not letting your country decline, and you have this violent movement of getting rid of the internal enemies and unifying your country by force and maybe waging expansive war.
Do you see in America today some of these very dangerous trends that are underway?
Well, I'm very reluctant to use the term fascism loosely. It's about the worst thing you can say because everybody remembers the death camps. Everybody still remembers those horrible scenes when the American soldiers arrived at the killing fields in eastern Germany and Poland and opened up those camps and saw those piles of bodies, which is fascism driven to its utter final conclusion. And it's a term that it's the nastiest thing. It's the most horrible label you can attach to anybody. But I think that if you looked at the history of these fascist countries, they started out without such violence, and there are some parallels. I don't think we have a fully developed fascist movement in America. There are a lot of people who are complaining about big government and taxes, but that's not fascism because fascists wanted a strong state. I think what we've got in this country is populism. People who there's a lot of people who are angry at politicians and who are bitter about losing their homes or their jobs, and they don't want to pay taxes, higher taxes, and they don't want government regulation. But that's not fascism. Fascism meant a dictatorship, more government regulation. It's populism, but I don't myself. I like it. I think it diverts us from the real problems at hand. I thought that back in the last decade, our government took some steps that sounded to me something like movement in that direction when we set aside the rule of law because we thought national security demanded it, like the Guantanamo camp. I thought that's to me had an echo. I think we occasionally took one or two steps in that direction without getting really there.
Well, yeah, since 9/11, it seems to have changed everything. You know, it just seemed to cast a pall upon America, and the people seem to be under some kind of really great influence, but that could easily be manipulated, be used to manipulate by some of the elites.
Yes, I think that it was a horrendous shock. I was, of course, living in New York, and it was an appalling shock, and we needed to keep a really steady hand at that point and to deal with it within our legal framework. And some of the time we did, and once or twice we stepped outside our legal traditions. And that was, I thought, a step in the wrong direction.
Okay, Dr. Paxton, thank you for being with us. We'll be right back. We have to take a brief commercial break here, and then we'll be right back and continue this conversation. But we certainly enjoy you being with us this evening. We'll be right back. Thank you, sir. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. And welcome back, Dr. Robert O. Paxton, author of, five books. Is that right, Dr. Paxton?
Yeah, six.
Okay, we got Parade.
Anatomy of Fascism, right.
And that's what we're talking about. You seem to be averaging one about a decade.
Well, I work fairly slowly, yeah.
Yeah, well, you started in 1966, so that's, you're doing better than most, sir. My question to you would be, there is a scholar that has put forth the claim that, and his name is Peter Del Scott, and he claims that after 9/11, there was a continuation of government, a COG issued, and that every year Obama, in fact, the reason why Peter Del Scott brought this up, was that it went under the radar on the news, but President Obama renewed the continuation of government, and that we're still, every year, we're still under a state of emergency since 9/11. Were you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that. I don't know about the fact that we're under a state of emergency. I'm not aware. I was not aware of that. I know that it has taken a long time to get the Guantanamo a prison wound down and dealt with. But the state of emergency, I'm not aware of that. I don't know about that legislation.
What was it, Dr. Paxton, about Guantanamo that you thought was just outright just unfair way outside the Constitution? Could you characterize it like that?
Yeah, well, I think that the central issue was the use of torture. Which is, it sometimes happens in the field, in the heat of battle, but it's not in our legal tradition. And I saw the films of those people in shackles and with their heads covered and so forth, and they were subjected to personal indignities, and that doesn't serve any intelligence gathering purpose. And that seemed to me to be stepping way outside of our legal traditions.
Right.
Absolutely. What are you familiar with the another piece of legislation? There are two that I wanted to ask you about. One was the Patriot Act that really brought a lot of searching without warrants, phone calls, and these type of things. What are your thoughts about the Patriot Act?
Well, I think that it probably went a good bit farther than was necessary. We actually had in our legislation a great many provisions that gave the executive a tremendous amount of power. There was, for example, we already had an arrangement whereby if national security seemed to be at stake, there was a legal panel that would authorize the use of wiretaps. And President Bush didn't want to go through that legal panel, even though it was named by the president and was not really a very independent body. He wanted wanted the president to be able to decide personally and directly, and that seemed to be entirely unnecessary. We have in urgent situations, presidents have gone through this legal panel and have gotten legal authorization to carry out wiretaps, and even that is an infringement of liberties. But we obviously have to find a balance between protecting ourselves and extending liberty to all, but it seemed to me we had a great deal of the mechanisms in place to deal with these problems with what we already had.
Do fascist regimes like the Nazis and Mussolini and them, do they put under surveillance more and more of their citizens? Is that sort of characteristic?
Absolutely, and they have an explicit doctrine that there is no no universal principles like the sanctity of human life and so forth. What really counts is the welfare of the nation and the safety of the nation and the aggrandizement of the nation. If something seemed to be threatening Italy or threatening Germany, they had no legal limit to what they could do. So in Italy, they started putting people in camps, and in Germany it went much further right from the first. The first camp was at Dachau, just outside of Munich, and that was in just a few months after Hitler took power. And those were not, those were dissidents, critics of fascism. They hadn't yet started the purge of the Jews. Members of Democratic and Socialist parties, though some of them were Jews, but they were in there because they were political opponents. And so those regimes practiced a very high degree of surveillance. They had secret police, and they rewarded people who turned in their neighbors and children who turned in their parents, and it was everyone felt like they were being watched.
Right. Are you familiar with Top Secret America? There was a series of articles about 854,000 people now that the government is employing with top secret clearances. And they've come about with these different agencies and so forth over the last few years. And they have nearly one out of every 300 Americans that has a top secret clearance.
Well,
and they're employed in all
yeah.
kinds of different security capacities.
Right. Well,
it's like you were talking about earlier.
Foreign intelligence. I don't think they're all snooping on us. I was in the Navy and Foreign Affairs branch, and I had a top secret clearance, and I was working on foreign intelligence. I don't think all those people are snooping on us, but I think it's something to watch. We don't want that kind of society. We want to be able to trace the people who want to do us harm, but we don't want to threaten the liberties of our own citizens.
Yes, that's right. I was in the ASA, Army Security Agency, which was, we reported to the NSA, but we certainly didn't operate within this country. But I'm afraid they have the capacity and authorization now to do that.
Yeah, when the CIA was set up, it wasn't supposed to work inside the USA, and they have the authority to do so. And I think
that's what's so troubling to many people, and you know what I mean? And it's scary to many Americans. They don't like the trends that have occurred since 9/11 in these areas that we just pointed out. And I think you're agreeing with that it could be a problem, right?
Well, I think it's something that we think we need to watch. I think that we've taken steps in the right direction. I think that there's a decisive turn away from the use of torture. I mean, I was for a time in a naval intelligence reserve, and I learned enough to learn that torture doesn't really work. Not only is it reprehensible, but it doesn't actually get you information. It gets you what the tortured person thinks you want to hear, and a skillful intelligence agent can use, can play upon a person's vanity and you seem to know more than he knows and get quite a lot of information out of somebody. Torture does not work as well as a skillful cross-examination.
Right.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Charlotte was in the Army and the Navy also.
Wow, I don't know many people who are in both the Army.
Yeah, she started out as a Navy swabby, okay? You know, Doctor... You know, I was Army, you know, and we have to put down these Navy people.
Well, thank you for being with us.
But we're going to be, we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back. We have two more segments with you, and thank you very much for being with us this evening. We certainly are enjoying the conversation. Thank you, Doctor. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to our special guest, Dr. Robert Paxton, an American historian, author of several books. And tonight we're talking about his book, The Anatomy of Fascism. Welcome back, Dr. Paxton.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I have a question, George, gentlemen, concerning international bankers. And it's my understanding that Ford Motor Company was actually making the tanks for Hitler. And when the Allies went in to bomb, they actually ended up destroying corporate property. So what does corporations and international bankers have to do with fascism?
Well, I think the company you mean is was General Motors. General Motors owned and still owns Opel, which is a big German automobile company. And when the war came, Opel made tanks, and General Motors, the Nazi regime took Opel out of the hands of General Motors, and they claimed they didn't really have anything to do with this, but it certainly was American property in Nazi Germany being used by the Nazi regime. But get back to the banking issue. The best view now is that the bankers and the industrialists weren't so keen on Hitler. They thought he was an economic radical, but they wanted someone a little more traditionally conservative. But when he got power, they made their peace with him, and they profited greatly under the regime. I think most of the German businessmen wanted to export, and German bankers wanted to do international banking. And when Hitler came to power, they set up economic nationalism and reduced foreign trade and exchange thing by border and controlled exchanges of currency and so forth. And the bankers and the industrials had to work under very different rules. But they liked that better than the Republic beforehand, because the socialists were very powerful in the Republic, and the trade unions were very powerful in the Weimar Republic. And they made their peace with Hitler. I think they thought of him as a lesser evil, and they got along okay, and they made a lot of money out of the Nazi regime.
Well, did the Catholic Church support Hitler, his rise to power?
Pardon me?
Did the Catholic Church support his
rise to power?
Yeah.
Well, a few of them did. I think they gave more money to people like Franz von Papen, who was a more traditional conservative. They gave some money to Hitler. Hitler got a lot of money out of his meetings. You had to pay a little bit to get into these rallies, and there were hundreds of thousands of people who came to listen to his harangues, and they sold insignia and pamphlets and stuff, and he was financed in part that way, and in part by the gifts of some industrialists. But it was after power, when the industrialists made their peace with him, and then they gave him a lot of money.
Well,
how about I.G. Farben? Do you have a handle on I.G. Farben? What happened to them?
Yeah. Well, I.G. Farben was the biggest corporation in Europe. It was a combine of chemical companies. Farben means colors. They made dyes, chemical dyes, and they put together this huge conglomerate of chemical and they were they profited tremendously by foreign trade. And they didn't really want to go the route that Hitler was going to take of closing the frontiers and having economic autarky. That's say producing everything within your country, everything devoted to defense. But once Hitler came to power, and they were happy enough to have the trade unions lose their power and lose the right to strike and so forth, and they learned to live under the new system, and they made tremendous amounts of money. They retooled and they reorganized to work for German rearmament. They made synthetic fuel. Germany doesn't have any oil, so they made synthetic fuel out of coal, and they made a fortune out of the Nazi government. But they didn't actually help him to power, but they helped him wage war. They helped him get ready for war, and that's what they were tried for after the war.
Right.
Well, I apologize. I stand corrected. It's General Motors, and it's Opel.
Yeah, it is General Motors, but the general gist of your question is accurate. There were American, it was American property in Nazi Germany, working for the German war effort. it had been taken out of their hands. Of course, it would have been sort of quasi-nationalized. But after the war, General Motors wanted to get it back. They got it back.
What about the Vatican?
Some of the wartime profits.
Yeah.
Well, they were
what
all
about
interested
the Vatican?
What Standard Oil of New Jersey was caught trading with the Nazis, were they not, through third parties?
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of companies. Well, we were neutral, you see, until Pearl Harbor. We were neutral until December 1941, and we were trading with a lot of people through third countries and so forth, surreptitiously, but sure.
Well, what about
an interesting story about William Stevenson coming to America and with a secret spy team to entice us into the war earlier than we might have been enticed into World War II?
Well, he came to Washington and the British Embassy too. They were doing everything they could to get the Americans to help England in its war effort, and Roosevelt wanted to do that, and indeed he got some things through Congress even before Pearl Harbor. There was the destroyers for bases deal, whereby we gave them 50 warships, and they gave us use of a bunch of British bases. And then there was lend-lease, we lent them the money and they leased the equipment, because we remembered that in the First World War, the countries like Britain and France had run up a huge war debt, and it just wrecked the financial system after the war. And then there was the draft. We started having selective service. We started having compulsory military service before Pearl Harbor. And so there were those tendencies. America was deeply divided. There were people who wanted to help Britain, and there were people who wanted to stay out of the war. And so the British embassy and people like Stevenson were trying to encourage those parts of America that wanted to help Britain. Britain, of course, was nearly on the ropes in the fall of 1940 and the spring of 1941.
Right.
That's true. And there are some people who go so far as to think that Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor and didn't say anything because he wanted us to go into the war. I don't believe that story, but
do you think 9/11 has been effectively much like a Pearl Harbor effect?
Well,
some of the elites?
It was a shock. I can't think of anything else that happened to the United States.
Do you think these elitists are really using it to manipulate the American public?
Well, I think Pearl Harbor was a much bigger thing. We were invaded by a foreign country. Our military base was attacked, and we lost a lot of ships, and we lost a lot of soldiers' lives, and it wasn't just Pearl Harbor, it was Wake Island and a lot of other bases, and we were open to Japanese attack, and that was a much, much more serious thing than 9/11. And after Pearl Harbor, of course, the country was completely turned around for war. I remember my father had just bought a 1942 Chevrolet, and they took it away from us just after December the 7th, 1941, and I was 9 years old, and I was really, really sore. I was ready to cuss out President Roosevelt, but that's what we did.
That's
we
right.
You
experienced some of this firsthand, did you not?
I did. I lived it as a child, but conscious of what was going on. But the 9/11 was much, much less serious than that. It was a criminal act. It wasn't done by a state. It was done by terrorists as part of a movement, and they killed nearly 3,000 Americans. It was a criminal act, and it deserved to be punished. We needed to be very careful about whether we perverted our own legal system and political system to carry out that punishment.
Right, I understand.
Yeah.
We're going to take another break here, and then we'll be right back with our concluding segment. We'd like for you to give us some suggestions about what to watch for and to ward off any possible bad trends in this country where we could stay away from. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with... Welcome back, Dr. Paxton.
Hello.
Yeah, welcome
Hello,
back
I'm
to
back.
Our program. Yeah, there's one little detail here I'd like for you to clear up. In Nazi Germany, pre-Nazi Germany, or right at the beginning, the Catholic Church, did they not have a treaty, a Lateran treaty with Nazi Germany? Is that right?
Correct. But
and I believe the Catholic Party at the time was the center party was their party, their political party.
That's correct.
Yeah, and they pushed, the center party pushed for a concordant with a new Nazi, actually with a German Republic, which preceded Nazi regime. Is that correct?
Well, the Vatican at that point was concluded concordats with all sorts of countries because they wanted to guarantee the liberty of their schools, the Catholic school system, and they had concordats with most countries, including dictatorships like Spain and Portugal and so forth. And so, in the summer of 1933, they had concluded one with Hitler. But they also the Catholic Party, the Center Party, didn't vote for Hitler before he came to power, but after he came to power, Hitler needed their votes not just a majority, but a two-thirds majority to get an enabling act in the spring of 1933 that would permit him to legislate by decree. And the Center Party voted for that. That was a bad thing to do. And the reward was to have a concordat which would protect the liberty of Catholic schools in Nazi Germany. Later on, it's true that there were some Catholic priests and even members of the hierarchy who criticized Hitler and who even resisted him, a few of them. Some of them were heroes that way, but in the beginning they had a share in consolidating Hitler's power.
Right. Do you feel that any new type of fascist regime would be a partnership between the corporate structure or the corporations and government, but government being the minor partner?
Well, I think what you had with the classical fascist regimes in Italy and Germany, you had a partnership between the party. It was a fascist party that was full of militants and fairly strong, and then you had the government, and the business interests were a third partner, and it was a sort of three-way partnership. But the party had the power, and as I said before, the businesses many of them regretted the era when they could trade abroad and so forth, but they were very glad to get rid of labor unions, and so they went along with it. I think you could speak of a three-way partnership between German business, the state, the government, the civil service, the state agencies, and the Nazi Party that had the upper hand.
Right. Have you taken a look at all about this G20 organization organizing this Basel Accord III, which they're reorganizing many of the international financial organizations and institutions. Have you looked at that at all?
I have not. Basel Accord III is something I have confessed I don't know about.
Okay.
By definition, the fascist regimes were nationalist and they were not internationalist. They were opposed to any kind of international organization. That's a different kind of a thing.
Right.
I'd say.
What's troubling to some of the patriot movement in this country is that they believe that this international reorganization will take away many of their rights and freedoms on the local level. There's Agenda 21 and things like this that are being pushed through the UN. And this is where it's troubling to many of the patriot people out there.
Yes.
Commissions, the Military Commissions Act and the Homeland Security, all that, Patriot Act and all that, since 9/11 has done nothing but give more and more power to our central government, to our federal government, and especially the president.
That has been a long-term trend in our country. The powers of the federal government grew during the First World War, and they grew during the Depression. And they grew during the Second World War, that's still going on. Sometimes it's useful, like the Pure Food and Drug Act, which I think protects us, and sometimes it's invasive. It's something to keep an eye on.
Right. What kind of recommendations could you give us Between now and the end of the program, we probably have about 5 or 6 minutes here. What would you recommend to our listening audience to watch for about our own government that might be helpful in citizens recognizing any troubling types of trends?
Well, I think that I think we want to be watchful about our civil liberties. It looks like the government is going to grasp too much power to arrest and to intern and to sentence without going through legal processes. This is a very big danger. I think that's one of the things to be looking out for. I think that there are times when there need to be some rules. I think the ideal thing is to be able to have the energy and the creativity of businessmen, but they need to have rules, like in a football game. You know, I think you don't want to just get out there and fight. There's the yard lines, and there's a referee, and there's rules. And with banking and industry, there needs to be rules. And I think we want to avoid a situation where banks and mortgage lenders and so forth can do anything they darn well please and create a big housing bubble or run up huge degrees of debt and market securities that don't have anything behind them. I think there need to be rules of that sort, and I don't think that's bad. I think we want to be able to simultaneously have the creativity of individual enterprise and then have some oversight, some rules. If the rules become stifling, then that's bad.
Well, one of the things I can see is recently they've enacted legislation that gives the Federal Reserve, which is a private corporation, more power to do as they please. Now, to me, that is really just wrong, you know, and I think Congress is way off base on many unconstitutional acts that they're enacting.
Well, the Federal Reserve we've had since 1913, and it has a curious hybrid nature. It is its own business, but it functions as a national bank, and
there's a lawsuit up in New York, Bloomberg. One of their reporters brought it against the Federal Reserve, and their Federal Reserve is refusing to give information on credits that they gave to overseas companies. I mean, it's lawlessness, like you're talking about in some of your excerpts and books, you know. It's beginning to be lawless at times, you know, in this country, seems like.
Yeah. We need to have rules, and we need that the government needs to be limited by rules, and it needs to play by the law as well. I don't know about a particular lawsuit, but the Federal Reserve mainly sets interest rates and things of that sort, and tries to affect the money supply. That seems to be a legitimate function when they claim to be above the law. Then that would be bad.
Right. Well, those are just some of the things. We represent a good portion of the Patriot movement, and you know, we're concerned like the Tea Party. What about this Tea Party movement? What do you think about that?
Well, as I said, some people have tried to make me claim it that fascist because they're, you know, angry and so forth, and I don't think that at all. I think they're populist. I think they're contradictory. They feel like not pay taxes and not have any government rules, but at the same time, most of them are very happy to have Medicare and Social Security.
There's a lot of people taking social programs and checks. I got you. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Paxton, for being with us. We certainly appreciate your time and trouble, and we certainly wish you well, and we'll ask you back sometime. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thanks very much for asking me.
Hey, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Well, Charlotte, we'll come back on the next top of the hour, and we've got Todd Fletcher sitting in for David Ray Griffin, okay?
going to be awesome. We'll see you on there
tonight. Okay, tune in.